Leslie Zampetti. I'm with Dunham Literary as an agent. I am a new agent. I transitioned a couple years ago, and before that I was a librarian in situations from consulting firms to NASA to elementary school libraries. I'm here with Anna Stein and Anna of ICM Partners, and Anna represents writers such as Hanya Yanagihara and Maria Semple, Ben Lerner, Nafisa Thompson-Spires, and Renee Zuckerbrot of Massey and McQuilkin Literary Agents. And Renee is a CLMP board member, and she represents writers Kelly Link, Dan Sean, Emma Walsh, Sean Vestal, and Karen Tidbeck, among others. So we will get started, and we're going to sort of carry this on as a conversation and then have time for audience questions at the end. And as David stated, this panel is being recorded, so please, if you have a question, come up to the audience mic or ask that it be passed back to you. Let's start at the beginning. What's a good way to find out if an agent is a good fit for you as a writer?
Okay, wow, that's I thought we were going to start off with softballs. Okay. Well, it starts with your work and the agent reading your work and evaluating your work. So if you send your query and the agent asks for the entire manuscript or the entire proposal and then reads it and then says, oh, I love this. I would love to discuss the possibility of working together. You set up a call or a meeting if you're in the same town. And then you talk about a lot of the things. And one of the things you will talk about is the manuscript and how the agent sees it in the marketplace. Whether the agent thinks it needs to be revised and what those revisions would entail. And so I'm going to give you an example of something that happened to a client of mine before she was a client of mine that I think will make really clear. So this client was having some trouble finding an agent, and she sent it to her manuscript to this one agent, and she had written at the time what was called a gifted amateur mystery. That category is sort of dead and buried, but it was sort of a humorous, lighthearted mystery. And this agent read and said, I love this book. It's great. I'd like you to make it really dark. And because this was the first nibble she had, she was like, wow, okay. And she called a friend of hers who was Karen Joy Fowler and said, I think I have an agent. The agent really loves it, but wants me to make it dark. And then Karen said to her, well, if you're going to write a dark mystery, wouldn't you have done that from the get-go? And she said yes, and Karen said, well, this is not the agent for you. So that's what we mean when you have a discussion about sort of a manuscript and how an agent sees it and how an agent would pitch it and which editors and publishers the agent would send it to. And then I'm going to say one more thing because I'm going to leave room for Anna to answer. The other question you might, and she can elaborate, the other question you should talk about is communication style, whether it's phone, email, will things go mostly through the assistant, how available you are, and I'll let Anna elaborate on that.
I agree with all of that. I would say if you're lucky enough to have choice, I mean, sometimes, a lot of the time, you're sending queries, and you get no response. You get cursory responses. You get rejections. And it can be very disheartening. But keep in mind, there are an infinite number of agents out there. I mean, not infinite, obviously, but there are a lot of agents out there, and they're always young agents coming up who are building their list. So the agents that you try in the beginning might be, you know, might be better known, but they don't have much time to read new work. So you know, don't be discouraged if you have 10 rejections, or 20 people haven't gotten back to you. Don't be discouraged. I mean, you know, you might want to think about the responses that you're getting, but don't be discouraged. There's so many more out there. But I would say one of the things to think about if you do have choice, if you are talking to several different agents who are interested, is, you know, what's important to you? Is money important to you? Is the way in which you're published, how you're positioned, important to you? Is your chemistry with your agent important to you? Do you feel more comfortable in a relationship that's you know, just business, or that's a bit warmer and it feels like your therapist is perhaps your therapist.
Agents are often also their clients' therapists and friend and all kinds of things.
There you go. So you know exactly what I'm getting at. My mother is a therapist. That's my excuse. So, you know, not that these questions will be answered for you necessarily in one or two conversations with the agents you're talking to, but it helps if you know those things about yourself, if you know what's important to you going in, it's a lot easier to make those decisions, and you'll be able to tell at least a little bit in your conversations what's important to the agent and what the agent's style is. And, you know, knowing about their other clients and the way in which they represent their other clients will also, you know, help to inform you.
Okay. Going back to one of the things that Renee said, was talking about this with Paul Azan, let's talk about the expectations for a relationship with an agent, both on the writer's side and on the agent's side. What should a writer expect, considering transparency or communication, submission policies? Are there standards that writers should kind of take for granted with that, or does that work personally for each agent?
During the submission process?
During the whole relationship process, but particularly during the submission process.
Oh, you mean what kind of communication? I mean, I'm all for transparency, and I have to say, you know, sometimes I'll make an offer of representation and I don't get the book and I'm disappointed. I mean, that's life, right? It's a beauty contest, a bake-off, whatever, right? You're competing. The only time I find that agents get angry is if you're reading something, you've requested a full, and you're, you know, 90 pages in, and then you get an email that says, hey, just want to let you know I've accepted an offer of representation. And I think, wait, I requested the full, and I understand maybe I wasn't your first choice, but then you shouldn't have sent it to me. I mean, and it's fine to have a first choice agent, there's nothing wrong with that, but then don't send it out to seven or eight other agents and give them the full. So I think what you do need to say is, I have an offer of representation, and I'm asking everyone to get back to me in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever the time frame is. But if you are sending a complete manuscript to an agent, the agent is going to assume that the writer is interested in you. And I've had people write back and say, well, my first choice agent, you know, weighed in. And I think, like, okay. I mean, I can sort of deal with not being someone's first choice, but to deliver it on a silver platter to me like that is not really kind. And I will say that it is a very small business, and I have had people who have not accepted my offer of representation come back to me. And quite often, I will say no, but I have said yes to people who did the right thing, which is notify all the agents, give everyone time to finish, talk to all the interested agents, and then sometimes you're not chosen, and then they realize their first agent wasn't a good fit. So you should always be completely transparent, the way that you would want us to be transparent with you during the submission process. That's how you should be. And Anna may feel differently about having something yanked after you've requested a full, but I don't know. That's the only time I find that, like, my colleagues or other agents I've been on panels with get angry as opposed to being disappointed.
Yeah. I mean, and that comes, part of that is you know, just asking for decency, and part of that is because, you know, we don't sit around reading all day. I wish we did. But we sit, when we're at the office, we are playing whack-a-mole with our email and with the phone, and finding time to read is really, I mean, bless you. Finding time to read is the hardest part of the job. You know, especially if you have, you know, children and, you know, other things in your life besides the books. It's, you know, it's really so when we do commit to reading something new, you know, it's a big chunk of our time, and you know, that's why it's so upsetting, because it feels like a slap in the face. I would say in terms of etiquette with communication, what you should expect from your agent. You should expect your agent to communicate with you. That is, get back to you. That is, not ignore you. But, you know, it might not be the same day. It should probably be the same day. But if they're, for example, you know, out of town or very busy, maybe, you know, give them a few days. Maybe if they're at a book fair, give them a week. But I would also say, if you're having difficulty with your agent, be transparent. And I'll give you an example. I had a new client. He was fairly young, And I'd taken him on, and we were doing edits on his short story collection. And my edits were pretty extensive, and he was I later learned, more resistant than I realized. And he had responded to them, and I think I'd sent more edits back, and there was a period of time when I hadn't heard from him, and I just figured he was working on the book. And then later on, I ended up sending it out, and I had lunch with an agent who, and remember, most of us are friends with each other. We all know each other, and mostly we like each other. So I was having lunch with one of our colleagues, and we were laughing about the fact that scouts were comparing two books that we had out on submission. And I said, tell me about yours, and he said, tell me about yours. And then we realized when we were talking about mine, he said, wait a minute, I had that in. I said, but that's impossible. I took him on when he only had two short stories. You couldn't have seen the manuscript. And he said, but I did. I gave him all these notes, and then I never heard back from him. And then we figured out the timing, that when he was feeling uncomfortable with my edits and with our relationship, he had gone to sort of play the field a little bit behind my back. It's fine. I've never brought it up with him. He was young. You know, I don't think I don't think that there was any ill will. I think that he was just figuring things out. But it was bad etiquette. And you know, someday when he's much older and more secure, I'll tell him about it. But that's the kind of thing. You know, if you're not comfortable with your communication or with the editorial relationship, any of it, just be transparent with your agent. It's always best.
That's the first I've heard of anything like that. And that is kind of amazing. And yes, it is a very small world, both for editors and agents. Obviously, being upfront with people and treating them as you would like to be treated is always a good thing. In that vein, obviously, if you have an agent, that's great. And you should be upfront about what you expect as well. It never hurts to ask the question. But for those who are maybe looking for a change of agents, or you find yourself in one of those relationships where it's not really working, how would you suggest going about making that change?
You mean firing your agent?
Let's call it what it is, yes, firing an agent.
Also the steps. I get queries from people who say, I'm thinking of leaving my agent. And I automatically write back and say, sorry, I don't consider work that's under representation elsewhere. I don't do it sort of as courtesy to my colleagues and friends. But also, people have a change of heart. And sometimes they call and break up with their agent, and the agent convinces them to stay. I mean, it's just lose-lose. So the first step is, if it's the wrong agent, you're not losing anything by not having representation, right? As opposed to having the wrong representation. So the first step, before Anna answers, is break up with your agent. But I will always say, I took on a client who's fairly well-known, and it took him a year to sort of realize he needed to leave his agent. And we're friends. We went to university together. And he called as a friend to ask me about stuff his agent was doing. And I said to him, after we were done chatting, I said, all right, now you need to call him and tell him, like, what you're having some issues with. And, you know, can he change this? Can he be more communicative? Can he, maybe read your work? He had a multi-book contract. I mean, can he sort of do those things? And a year went by, and clearly he couldn't. So if you like your agent and you think your agent is good, you might want to give the agent opportunity to correct that behavior that you find troubling. It's possible the agent will also automatically just say, no, you know what, it's not working for me either. Wish you well, and let's part ways.
But obviously, just like in romantic relationships, it's good to be off with the old before you're on with the new. Anna, do you have anything else you want to weigh in with that?
I would say, going back to transparency, it's really useful information if you feel like your agent isn't working for you anymore. Maybe you feel like they don't love your work enough. Or maybe you don't feel like they're catching the balls that are coming at you, or who knows what it is. I would just be really, really transparent about it. Just be really upfront with them. Say, this isn't working for me for this reason. Or I feel like we've become friends, but I'm not sure that it's a business relationship that's really working for me anymore. And it's always best to break up in a way where everyone feels good about it, because who knows, maybe 10 years down the line you'll realize, you know, that it was a much better relationship than you realized, and you'll want to go back. Or maybe you'll end up wanting your former agent's clients to blurb your book. Maybe you'll be asking your former agent for a favor. I mean, there are an infinite number of reasons to be decent, and transparency often goes along with decency.
Okay. One of the things that people always ask about that I hear, especially in the kidlit world, I'm assuming it's very similar for the literary world, is how important is the query letter versus the sample pages?
I think we have different ideas about this.
About the query letter or sample pages?
Yeah. I'm going to go first this time because I think you'll have more to say about it. So for me, the important thing about the query letter is that I don't want it to read like a query letter. I don't want it to read like the boilerplate that everyone teaches you to write. Which, and this is, you know, I think I'm different from other agents this way, but I like to see a little bit of like a real person behind it. I like to see somebody saying, "Dear Anna" or "Dear Ms. Stein," you represent so and so and so and so, you know, who are heroes of mine, and you know, I like to think that my novel is in the same genre that, you know, you'll find some value in it. And then a very short description. I don't want to know everything that happens in your novel. I don't care about the plot. I want to know sort of generally, where is it set? What's the idea? What's the gist of it? What do I absolutely have to know? And then what I want to know more than that is, who are you? And, you know, where do you come from? Are you somebody who's gotten an MFA? And don't think necessarily that that's going to count in your favor, because these days I feel very, personally, I've been feeling very MFA averse, because I feel like there's a uniformity that's coming out of the MFA program. Or, you know, are you a first-time writer? Who comes from a different industry? Have you published magazine articles, or short stories? Something that will tell me sort of, you know, let's say I fall in love with your work. How do I position you to the publisher? How do I talk about you to the publisher? And how will the publisher talk about you? When it comes down to it, at the sales conference and so on. I'll give you an example. The last debut novelist I took on had no credits to his name. He'd never written anything except for this novel, and as it turned out, a second novel he had just finished. And he came to me. It was a referral, but I read it because the description sounded. Like unlike any description that I'd read recently, it didn't sound. It sounded organic, and his letter felt real and organic. And his bio was that he had worked in the fashion industry for all of his career, and he's at the top of his career. He's doing very well, but he's been writing all this time secretly. And I liked that. I liked that, you know, he was this sort of closeted. He's very good at what he does, but he was a closeted writer. And as it turned out, you know, it was wonderful. I took it on. I'll turn this over to you now.
I'm always looking for something personal, a query letter. So I'm not a fan of, you know, dear, if you can spell my name right, it's sort of okay, I guess, if you can't. Dear Ms. Zuckerbrot, you know, I've written a literary fiction novel. I get a lot of those. I don't know what a fiction novel is, but apparently there are a lot of them. So, you know, if you start off by describing your work as a fiction novel, I'm pretty much Xing out of that right there, because writers don't talk about fiction novels, or maybe they do. They talk about fiction or novels. So I'm not looking, like Anna, for that boilerplate. I tend to get seduced by voice. So I want a voice on the page in the manuscript, and I prefer a voice, even if it's like odd and nerdy, in my query letter. Maybe something that's a little bit like me. Just like a little bit like, who are you as a person, is much more interesting than a boilerplate or something that says, I've written a novel that's 120,000 words. And I think, that's the most important thing to you is the word count. I mean, that's not, you know, the most important thing. So I want a sense of who you are on the page. And I remember a query that I got from someone who had actually, it turns out, published a couple of stories that I had somehow managed to miss in Tin House and a couple of other places. And he was writing about being a lapsed Mormon and how this was sort of personal and how his collection deals with what it means to sort of question faith and lose faith, be faith, you know, have, be spiritual, all through the lens of a Mormon experience. And it was so personal that, and this was sort of reflecting who he was, I was like, sure, I'll read it. And, it, you know, I took it on. It was a really great collection. I mean, the guy could write. And I do get queries where people have great publication credits, and then I read the work, and I don't fall in love with it. So this was a combination of someone having and getting on his own, you know, published in McSweeney's and Tin House, but then also in his query letter sounding like a person and not like, you know, he didn't sound – his query letter didn't sound like something that came off an assembly line, which I think too many – because there's this formula. And so – since that's the first impression you're making, right, is this query letter, I would share it with friends, like friends you meet here, fellow MFA students, because it seems to me a pity to work 6 or 7 years on a novel and then write a really crappy query letter. And they're very hard to write. I used to write jacket copy when I was an editor. And I would, you know, I remember thinking this was the hardest thing to try and sort of make something sound really exciting, you know, in X number of words. I'd rather edit a manuscript than sit here and have to write copy that's going to sell the book. And I sometimes find that way it takes me a while to write a really great submission letter. And so I think this is something everyone struggles with. So I think you should know that editors will talk about struggling with jacket copy or catalog copy, and agents sometimes talk about getting their submission letter right. So it's okay if the query letter doesn't come naturally to you. The other thing I would say that's really useful about a query letter, if you cannot describe your book, you might want to think whether it's ready to go out.
I would second that completely. You don't necessarily have to be able to meet me and have an elevator pitch, but if you can't explain in a few sentences what your book is about, there's a larger problem with your book, because even highly literary novels have jacket copy, they have a blurb, they have something that tells us what they're about. And whether it's the reader, the editor, the agent, or the reviewer, somebody is going to have to distill your book into a very few sentences. And if you can't do it, how can they?
Two things to add. One is think about what we call comp titles. This book is a cross between X and X. My influences are so and so and so and so. That's always just helpful for us to know, because if you're naming books that we love, that's helpful information. If you're naming books that we happen not to love, that's also useful information. Another thing to keep in mind is that, you know, we're asking for you to sound sort of intimate in these letters and to talk to us person to person without us knowing each other, which is really difficult. And it's also difficult for some people to do that without being kind of jokey. And I find the jokey tone, the kind of jocular, wink, wink tone in query letters. I don't know why, but I find it to be a real turnoff. I would recommend as formal, if you're able to strike that tone between formal and warm. I mean, you know, I'm asking you to do this. You're the writers. I'm not a writer, and I find writing submission letters to be virtually, like, I find it to be so difficult. I ask my assistant to draft something before I even get into it. I respect what you guys do. I can't do what you guys do. But if you're the writers, then we can ask this much of you, that your pitch letters strike this very difficult tone between intimate and formal.
So what I'm hearing...
Can I just add something? So at the end of the day, what you're suggesting is a business relationship. And so I get people who sometimes write and say, hey, Renee. I mean, even get, hey, Renee. I'm sending you this query. I know you want the first 3 chapters as an attachment. I'm just sending in the body of this email. And So many things go through my head. So there's that, like, hey, I know what you want, but hey, I'm not going to give it to you thing, which I don't know if that's, like, jokey. But then I think, ooh, how is this person going to work with an editor or a publisher? Like, hey, I know you want me to do this, Random House, but hey, I'm going to do this instead. I mean, that's, like, the first impression. And I'm thinking, if you can't, and I'm so, and here's the other thing we should talk about. Every agent has different requirements. And I'm sorry we haven't gotten together and streamlined this for you. But my eyes are great, and I don't want to read 10, 20 pages of 10-point type in the body of an email. Because it's not for me. I want an attachment. And if I like what I'm reading, I will print out the entire attachment, read those three chapters, and ask for more. But Anna's a little younger, so she's okay probably with 10 points. Maybe not. Okay, maybe. See, everyone is sort of different. Some people say, don't send me any attachments. I use a Mac. I'm less worried about viruses. People on PCs are like, no attachments. So it all depends. So I would say go to the agent's website and see what they're asking for. And I know it's a pain, but that's life. Right?
Or just ask. Just write an email saying, I'd love to send you something. May I?
Yeah.
That brings us to a very important point, which is, like much in life, follow the directions. And it is important that you follow the directions. Almost every agent does have their website, or you can follow them on Twitter these days, which makes it even easier if they're on Twitter, that will give you the guidelines for what they're specifically asking for. So, for example, Renee is saying, I don't want to read this in the body of the letter. I want attachments. At Dunham Literary, we don't take attachments, but we only ask for 5 pages. We don't ask for 3 chapters. So you need to... It does become very personal, and it's important to think of the person on the other end of the letter as a person. I think one of you said that as well, is keep that person in mind while you're writing that letter. It's a business letter, but just like if you're sending a business letter to a company, there's somebody at the other end who's receiving that. One resource that I would mention is that Janet Reed has a website called Query Shark. If you do not follow it and read it, I recommend that you do so immediately, because she basically takes them to pieces and then improves them. And many, many times I will see people who are saying, oh, I have a great query letter. I sent it into Janet and got it critiqued. Or I followed her blog and I looked at it. And after so many, it became much easier to write. So there are resources out there besides the typical how to write a query letter 101. We did the follow directions. Let's talk about social media. Are either of you on social media? And do you think that is important for writers these days to have a presence?
I'll go ahead. Personally, I am on Facebook, and I'm on Instagram. Instagram is to post pictures of my children.
And
it's not for work,
so
and they're very cute.
They are really cute.
Facebook I use for work, and I post reviews and I post things like that I'm shamelessly broadcasting into the universe. And I'm not on Twitter. So I'm not very good at social media. I'm not on Twitter. I don't want to be on Twitter. I'm not good at it. So if I were a writer and, my agent were saying, work on this a bit more before your book comes out, I would think, all right, where's my, what are my strengths? Well, cute children. Will I use that platform? People care more about those pictures than they do about the reviews I post. And I would weigh it, and I'd probably end up saying no. But if you are, for example, if you are on Instagram and if you do have a bit of a following on Instagram, that is what you will need to exploit. If you are on Facebook, same. And if you're on Twitter, then I would say the most helpful of the platforms. If you're not on any of them, or if you're not very good at them, then forget about it, because you're not good at them and they don't come naturally to you. And if your publisher asks you to get on social media, you can politely decline, or you can say, I'll do it, but I don't think it's going to be very helpful because I don't have a presence already. If you have a bit of a presence and you're hoping to, you're hoping to publish a book in the next few years and, you're not bad at it and you don't dislike it, then now is the time to get better at it and to try to get more followers and to follow more people and do all of that stuff.
I would add that social media is not the magic bullet. So every couple of years, publishers are like, hey, we found the magic bullet. We know how to move books. So Facebook was it for a period. Twitter was it. not Instagram, Tumblr was it for a hot minute. It doesn't really work that way. You sometimes will look at a writer on Twitter and look at the number of followers. And then if you try to extrapolate book sales from that, you might never write again. I mean, occasionally some of the, like Stephen King, right? There are some sort of outliers. But number of Twitter followers, Facebook friends, Instagram followers normally doesn't translate into anything meaningful in the sales way. For fiction, occasionally for nonfiction, something platform-driven, it's very different. But for fiction, I agree with Anna. I think if you like social media, if you like being on Facebook, so I was on Facebook until the 2016 election, and then I just thought I started to lose my mind, and I found the whole thing seriously depressing. And so I didn't delete my account, which I probably should have, but I left it up there. And every once in a while, I'll sort of mosey on and I'll post something. But not really. I tend to be mostly on Instagram. I like sharing photos of my cute dog.
Very cute dog.
because people seem to like the cute dog. But the one thing I will say about social media, if you're on Twitter or Facebook, use it not only to talk about good things that are happening with your writing. You need to be a really good literary citizen. And I have to say, I've unfollowed writers who just are like, me, 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 who will even say like, oh, I have another thing, like a humble brag thing to share. I'm done. I don't want that. So you need to sort of give shout outs to writers you admire, to friends who are doing well, to colleagues. If your publisher has published a book that's doing really well, like, you need to be a good literary citizen. And that's one of the purposes, I think, of Twitter, or how it's sort of been transformed, is it allows you to sort of connect with other writers and other artists, but not just about your work. It's really, I saw Anna shaking her head, it's really tedious, right? Nodding her head.
Yeah, and I would also say my clients who have the best success on social media, who are novelists, are those who are constantly posting about what they're reading, and so they're always, you know, they'll take a picture of whatever book it is, and they'll say something nice about it, and it's just amazing the responses they get. You know, it's not just likes. I mean, people say, oh my god, I love that, or oh, I was going to pick that up, or you know, and then you get genuine organic excitement about a book. It's not your book, it's somebody else's book. But that kind of goodwill and that kind of community that happens on Facebook, and I imagine it too with Twitter too, is exactly what we've lost in a sense with, you know, by losing, you know, bookstores and losing losing book reviews, and you know, there's genuine literary community there. So if you can be a part of that, then I would say that's truly valuable.
So what we're taking from this is it's more important to be a good citizen. And the whole point of social media is the positive social and not advertising yourself, which does get incredibly tedious. There are people I have unfollowed specifically because I never see anything about other people and not just their personal lives. And it's also important not to put too much of your personal life on there unless you just like to be bare because it is public. But people who it is, I just released my book. It's on Amazon Kindle for $2.99 every 3 weeks. Please don't do that. I would say also, while we're talking about social media, while it's important to use that if you can, also about agencies' websites to learn more about agents, it is not a good idea to become a stalker. I recently had something sent to my home. As you can see, I have a fairly unusual last name. While there is more than one Zampetti family in Manhattan, surprisingly enough, oddly enough, somebody figured it out and mailed something. And when I opened it, I didn't realize that it was a query. I thought it was just something coming from Goodreads or one of the many publishers' books that I get. And as soon as I realized it was a query, it did feel creepy and it felt very invasive. And I was completely relieved to find out, thankfully, through social media, that there were many other agents who had had the same exact experience, all of us who had unusual last names, and all who felt the same way. So please follow the directions, follow the guidelines, and keep in mind, even though it is a personal relationship, it's a business relationship. And I think that's what we keep coming back to, what Renee said, is you're entering into a business partnership with someone with this. Is there anything specifically that you can give people advice? Because one of the comments we often get is, I got the call and now I don't know what to ask. What do I ask an agent? Because they're so focused on what the agent is going to ask them and how they answer it that they forget that it works both ways.
I'll let you go first.
Okay, thanks. I would say that the first thing to do is talk about the work. Ask the agent why they liked it, what work they think needs to be done. You know, if they had publishers in mind for it when they were reading it and who they were, how they imagine pitching it, all of the questions I imagine that would be running through your mind anyway are the questions you should be asking the agent, and that's specific to the work. And then, you know, the bigger picture questions, which are, how do you like to communicate, by phone or by email? What's normal for you as an agent in terms of frequency of being in touch? Do you like me to check in regularly, or should I just go do my thing and tell you when I'm ready? If you're not particularly well acquainted with a client list, maybe you could ask questions about other clients and about their relationship if you feel comfortable doing that. And then, you know, one of the questions that comes up sometimes, which is I find to be a bit uncomfortable, is the question of, well, how much money do you think you can get? And that's it's a legitimate question, but it's a tricky question for an agent to answer because, it's a tricky market, and you just never, even if you think you know, you never know. But I think if it is on your mind, it's okay to ask, so long as you remind yourself that an agent's quoting a bigger number doesn't necessarily mean that the agent is more enthusiastic or is going to get a bigger number for you.
Yeah, that is actually that last bit Anna was talking about. That's my least favorite question because, it's not like real estate where you say, okay, I live on this block and here's the size of my apartment and basically the average apartment goes for X per square foot, right? So you have sort of a ballpark. Publishing doesn't work that way. And even if you have comp titles, you can't say, well, I know this title sold for X and this title sold for X. So this is what your book is going to sell for. And my thinking about this is it's sort of you're doomed if you give an answer, whatever your answer is. If the answer is too high, right, and you end up selling it for less. So let's just say I'm going to throw some numbers out there. Let's just say you say, I think I can sell this for $300,000. And you end up selling it for $220,000. $220,000 is a really great deal, right, for a debut novel. But you might be thinking, God, I thought $300,000 because, she said $300,000. So instead of celebrating at $220,000, you have this random number stuck in your head. Now, if as an agent you give too low a number, right, it's possible the writer might think, wow, why does the agent only think she can sell it for $300,000? I think this is a $500,000 book. So either way, you're doomed. So the answer I say is, I think this is a really great book and I can make you a great deal. If I didn't think that was the case, I wouldn't have offered representation. And it's hard to say what the market will bear. And, sometimes you take on a project and you don't take it out for a year and the market changes. So it's really hard for me at that point to say what the market will be like in 6 months, 9 months, or 12 months. We're not, we can't sort of forecast that far into the future.
I would also say that the books that I'm going to speak personally. The books that I have loved the most that I've taken on have, for the most part, this isn't always true, but for the most part, I've had exactly one offer for them. So, that's because my taste is literary fiction, and literary fiction is hard to sell. But if one of them were to ask me, or if I were to take on somebody right now who fell into that category, and they said, well, how much do you think you could get for my novel? I would say, somewhere between $5,000 and $400,000. because, you know, because that's been my experience. I mean, I might send out something that I think is truly a contemporary classic, and all the publishers come back to me saying, you're right, this is incredible. This is the best writing I've seen in ages. This is, I love it, love it, love it. But my sales and marketing people won't let me offer. And, you know, that's almost like my mantra. Like, that's what I hear, you know, that's what I hear more often than not. And, you know, that means that we might end up selling it to, you know, to Coffee House or to Tin House or to Grey Wolf or to Catapult for a lot less money. And guess what? Sometimes they publish it a hell of a lot better than the publishers who are offering, you know, six figures. You know, it's great if you get $200,000 for your novel, but when it publishes to crickets, it doesn't feel that good.
I would add a caveat on that. The numbers they're talking about are traditionally advances, which means you then have to earn back all that money in royalties. So one of the things we at Dunham like to advise, especially our debut authors, is that having a stellar, amazing six-figure deal can be a handcuff to you because then you have to earn that all back. If you have a lower advance, you have a better chance of actually earning it back, which gives you a better chance of a better advance for your next contract. So it is a business. We don't like to think of it that way. One of the best pieces of advice I heard recently was at another conference, which was that you have to be happy with your writing in itself. Because if you're in it for money, you're in the wrong business. We do this as a business, but you have to get some of that fulfillment through the writing itself. And we tend to forget that, especially those of us who are agents, and that is our business.
The other thing... I would share sort of along those lines. This is an experience I had with someone who's now a former client who was never really happy. And I think that's because he saw himself only as a writer, first and foremost, despite the fact he was a husband and a son and a sibling and a parent and a mentor. He had so many different wonderful things going on in his life. And I should add, he had two books at PRH. I mean, it's not that he didn't have any book deals. And everything, he was always looking for exterior, outside validation. And when his first book didn't set the world on fire, despite getting like great reviews and some other things, you know, he internalized all of that. And I was always trying to sort of, you know, talk him down from the ledge and say, but hey, you know, you got these great reviews and I just got you another book deal. You know, they want to publish you again. And then like, but you have to sort of think of yourself, if you're sort of, if all the validation comes from reviews and sales and awards, I would say that sort of long-term, you're probably not going to have a really happy life. And to really sort of rethink where writing and being a published writer sort of falls on a spectrum and to sort of realize that there's so many things and it's not just sales. And I know, I mean, I'm not trying to sound like anyone's therapist, but this is something that I had a writer, we were together a long time, and it was always like a struggle because I was always hearing about how this person got that and this person, this writer got something else. But I would think you have all these other amazing things. And I remember he even got this job that after he got this job, like writers I don't even know wrote to me to say, God, your client got this tenure track position that everyone wanted. And, you know, so I think a little perspective, and by the way, we have to have that perspective too, because sometimes we take on books and we're like, oh, this one's going to set the world on fire. And then it doesn't. And then if you're just thinking like, wow, I'm an agent and maybe this year I didn't have a great year, some of the books that I had high hopes for just sort of fizzled out, like you're also going to be unhappy. So I give this advice as advice that I take for myself as well, that, you know, I try to take anyway. So just think about where writing fits in your life and don't sort of put all your eggs in one basket.
On that note, let's open it up for audience questions because that tends to be the popular part. Yes, and can you please use the mic?
Oh, I didn't know there was a mic.
Is this turned on? It probably isn't, is it?
Probably
not turned on.
Yeah, that didn't make a big
difference.
It's usually on the side.
Oh, okay. What is the range, if at all, of promotion activities that some agents
will take on versus the range of similar activities that the author and the publishing house take on.
So technically, it's not our job. When it comes to publicity and marketing, that falls under the publisher's responsibilities. But, you know, we want the book to do well. And if we feel like there's anything we can do to help make that happen, we will do it. So, for example, maybe we'll say, hey, I know when we're sending the book out for blurbs, I've got these two clients and I'm friendly with these three other authors, or I know someone who can get to them. You know, your agent will often help out in that way. Or let's say, you know, we're friendly with somebody who's running a reader series. You know, we'll try to put the book under their nose. I mean, in some ways, it's organically part of our job, and that, you know, we're part of the community, and we're always, you know, trying to do the best we can for the book. But the actual job of publicity and marketing falls to the publisher.
So I would just agree with what Anna said, that we do get involved, but we have to allow the publisher to drive the bus. So sometimes I have friends who are reviewers, and if I want to, you know, send a galley on my own, I first check in with the publicist and say, you know, do you mind if I send a set email? Because you don't want one outlet or one reviewer getting like seven different emails, like the writer, so you have to sort of coordinate it, and you have to allow the publisher to do their job, but you certainly can pitch in.
Up here in the front.
Thank you. I was just wondering, for the novels you take on, choose to represent, kind of, is there a range of novels that need like a lot of edits, major like overhauls, or just minor revisions, stuff like that? Just in general, what kind of do you usually get? Any sense?
It all depends. So because I have more clients now than when I started, it's really hard for me, and I'm a former editor. I used to be at Doubleday. So it's hard for me to sort of make the case to take on something that really needs an overhaul. But that leads to another question. You would want to talk to many agents. I mean, and see, do you agree with someone who wants to overhaul a novel? Or maybe an agent who says, you know what, there's this fix that we can do. So the point when an agent edits a novel is not to necessarily make it perfect for the agent, because the agent isn't actually publishing it, isn't signing off on the delivery and acceptance check. So my thinking is, when I send something out, I mean, I don't want a client to do a gazillion edits because it's not quite perfect according to Renee Zuckerbrot. What I want to have when I send something out is a novel that's really great, okay, that's clean, right? Not sloppy, not full of typos, weird formatting things. And when the editor at the other end is reading it, the editor says, I know exactly what this is. I know exactly what the author's doing. And, you know, the author has done it. I have a couple of ideas, you know, for revision, and I see ways to sort of maybe, I don't know, make the pacing a little better or whatever it is. But the editor reading it on the other end, so I need to get something into good enough shape, great enough shape, so that someone reading it knows what it is. Does that make sense? Because when I was an editor, I would sometimes get manuscripts and I'd start reading and I'd think, oh, this is X. And then I'd continue reading and I'd say, no, it's Y. And then I'd say, oh, wow, there's like another letter of the alphabet. And I had no idea. And then I'd stop reading and I'd think, I don't actually know what this is. So it wasn't right for me, or maybe the book wasn't finished.
I'm a bit of a perfectionist, but I would say I'm not going to take something on if it needs a real overhaul. We don't have the time or resources to put in that level of work. I'll do rounds, I'll do drafts, for as long as I think, you know, is necessary before I send it out, because I know how hard it is to get a deal for the kind of books that I love. I want them to go out looking as perfect as possible. And sometimes that's line edit, sometimes that's structural. It depends on the book.
I would just add that, and I do write myself, if you're talking with agents and one of them is asking you to basically completely revise your book, you should make sure that is in line with your vision for the book. My colleague Bridget Smith and I actually both wanted to offer for a particular client, and since she has seniority, she won and she made the offer. But one of the points under discussion is we both had very different visions of the book. And, of course, Dunham then lost to another agent from another agency who happens to be a good friend of Bridget's. And it was interesting to me to hear that because the third agent and myself both had very similar visions for what the book is, which was obviously more consonant with what the author wanted as opposed to what Bridget was proposing. So that's something to keep in mind, that it's not that if anybody asks you to do work, that's bad, but you do have to keep in mind what you are trying to do and is somebody trying to make the book something else. And where that goes. Next question. Let's try for the back. Yes.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I'm just curious, and I really enjoyed your story about how gentle you were with this kind of misguided younger writer. And I'm curious, how do you each think about writers who are in their 20s? And what are maybe your things that make you hesitated or excited about working with a writer of that age?
I myself am not, believe it or not, I'm not an ageist. I like, when I read something, I like to know as little as possible about the writer. In fact, by the time I read a submission, I've already forgotten. My system is if I request something, it goes onto my iPad. It goes into my queue and my iPad. And I'm always months behind in my reading. I'm not exaggerating. I mean, really months, like, you know, 6 months behind in my submission reading because I have a lot of clients who I'm reading. So by the time I pull something up, I have no idea. I mean, if the author's name, is there, I might know the gender depending on the author's name. But otherwise, I have no idea who's writing the book. So it doesn't really matter to me.
Yeah, age doesn't matter at all. It's more sort of when you talk to the author about representation, sort of what the person is like, their expectations. You might hear agents talk about managing expectations. I had a young writer approach me, and I read a bunch of her short stories. It was a collection that she hadn't quite put together, but I had sort of read a bunch of her things in magazines. And when we were talking, all she kept talking about is winning the Pulitzer Prize and winning this prize. She was young, and that prize. And I finally said to her, you know, that's a little out of my control. Like, sometimes I can't even get the publisher to submit. I shouldn't admit that. But occasionally, like, it's up to the publisher to submit. There's some things which the awards committee will request. But, like, you know, if it were up to me, yeah, all my clients would get all these awards. So clearly it's not up to me. But that was someone who was very young, and I thought, okay, that for that person, this is all about external validation, and we are probably not a good fit.
Next question here. Yeah.
Sorry. Hello. I'm wondering, I'm writing a novel, and when I go to query that novel, I'm wondering if I should mention other types of writing that I do. I'm a person that is a songwriter and more recently screenwriting. And so is the agent going to want to know those kinds of things? Because is that something a literary agent represents?
I'll actually take that one. I would say that's a very good question because it will depend again on the agent. At our agency, we believe in representing the career. That said, we don't represent screenwriting and we don't represent songwriting. So in your case, we might say, okay, we will represent you for your books. There are agencies that do represent other things, including screenwriting, and so that's something you would want to research about the particular agent and agency to see how they would manage that. I personally feel it doesn't hurt because then we have an idea of your facility with language beyond the one piece of writing that you're going, that you're submitting.
Yeah, I agree. It doesn't. It's just another biographical fact about who you are and what you're doing. So, I mean, you're not a school teacher or a doctor. You're a songwriter, in addition to writing a novel, and a screenplay writer.
And we're still okay. I think there's been one over here that's been here for a while.
Oh, sorry, I'm making you run.
I was wondering if you had if the author had an agent and things didn't work out, when you start querying again, do you mention that in the new query letter?
I think the answer is no if your work hasn't gone out. No one needs to know. Like, if the first agent did not submit your work, then it's not relevant, meaning, like, the playing field is wide open. Right. But when you would need to mention it is saying, like, okay, I had this agent, and she sent it to, you know, 32 editors. Right. Because, you know, that we might evaluate the work a little sort of differently because it's possible, you know, we may not be able to go out wide.
Right.
But that said, there are stories where, you know, someone went from one agent who had submitted work to another agent who then made a great deal. So, I mean, the rules are made to be broken. But going back to transparency, I think we just want to know. You'd want to know, right?
Yeah. I have an example where an old friend of mine from high school said, do you remember so-and-so? She, you know, she wrote this book. She wrote this memoir. Her agent couldn't sell it. And now she's wondering if she should self-publish it or what to do. Would you mind just giving her some advice? And I thought, okay, fine. Okay, yes. Hi. All right. Tell me about your book. And she did. And I said, that sounds pretty funny. It sounds good. And I didn't feel at that point. I didn't feel like I could advise her unless I looked at a little bit to get an idea of what it was. And then I started reading it, and it was really good. It was really funny. And then I read the whole thing, and I went back and I talked to her about, and I looked at the way her agent had positioned it and what hadn't worked. And I was lucky because I was the second one in, so I could, you know, I could analyze what hadn't worked, and I had ideas about how to restructure it, and then we were able to sell it, you know. So, and that was total transparency all the way through, and it ended up working out. Yeah.
You've been asking, I think, for a while here in the front.
I had two questions. One is, Anna, you said about the MFA. You said to mention it, but then you said you don't like it. So, and I didn't put an MFA in my bio for that reason, because I know the whole, like,
some people
workshop.
Love it.
So you just, you take your chances.
Look, it's a fact of life. You got an MFA. There's no backing out of it now.
That's true.
Anna Stein might be slightly prejudiced against you for that, but, you know, but for a lot of agents, it's a great thing. And you know, I mean, go with transparency. I mean, why not? You know. Yeah.
My other question is: is it appropriate to ask agents about their success rate in terms of people that they take on and then actually find a publisher for them, or is that data that can be researched?
Do you keep statistics?
No. I mean,
do you have a chart?
I would say it's an okay question to ask. It's probably not something you can research. It's something that agents don't usually feel comfortable talking about because we're ashamed when we can't sell
bad.
Something. We feel really bad about ourselves. But it's a totally legitimate question, and you know, if you're going to have a working relationship with an agent, you want them to be able to answer you honestly.
I'm actually narrow the question. So let's say you've written a romance. I don't know, I'm just throwing that out there. I think you might say, like, what's your track record with romances? Like, how do you feel about this? Because I have people sometimes coming to me and I think, ooh, I don't really know. I have mixed feelings. I don't really know about this. Or I've even made offers of representation when people ask me. And I say, you know, this is new, but here's my thinking and here's what I've done. So I think maybe narrowing your question as opposed to, like, everything you've submitted in your entire life also isn't going to give you the information that you need, because what if I have sold every single short story collection I've ever submitted, but, you know, my track record with something else isn't that great. Those numbers get combined, and so it's actually not accurate to what you might be asking. I just threw, by the way, short stories out there. I'm not saying that I've sold every collection I've ever submitted, but I'm just saying this is why you should narrow it.
Renee makes a very good point. You should definitely narrow it because agents do specialize in genres. So, for instance, right now all of my clients are in kid lit. That's not the only thing I'm looking for, but that's my track record of sales. I would also add one more caveat. One of the things that we see that's becoming very popular is people asking us questions about Publishers Marketplace, because you can now purchase memberships and log on and see what deals are being announced and what they sold for and things like that. Not every agent reports the deals. So there are highly successful, very highly thought of agents who just aren't interested in reporting that. And you're missing out because then you think, oh, well, I haven't seen that necessarily. That doesn't mean they're not selling. It just means they're not reporting it to Publishers Marketplace. So you do need to keep that in mind if you're using that as part of your research.
Thank you.
Let's go back right here.
Where am I going?
Gentleman, right?
Okay.
Oh, wait. Thank you. Very illuminating session. I wanted to ask you, I know this is personal after all. Writing is personal. I assume the way you approach books is too. So what's the last book you fell in love with and why? And what is your process for falling in love? I don't mean a formula, but what are the things that speak to you uniquely?
If I could just restate that because they're recording it. She's basically asking what's the last book you fell in love with and why, and what's the process for falling in love with that book or that writer?
I'll let you go.
The debut I mentioned earlier, the one by the man who worked in fashion, I fell in love with that novel, and it was about real people. I mean, it was as it turned out, it's autobiographical, but it felt very real to me. Every scene in the novel, I felt like I could see, hear, smell, touch everything that was in the scene. It's a novel that's set in Glasgow during the Thatcher era, and it's about a benefits/working-class family, an alcoholic mother, and the little boy who ends up being the one to take care of her. And I just couldn't believe how true, how authentic it all felt. So that was it for me.
Yes, for me, it's a short story collection by someone who's a first-generation American who is writing, I think, from some of his own personal experiences about his family coming here as immigrants and trying to fit in. And especially, he's the youngest of two children, and he was born here. And he is completely American, everything from the way he dresses to the way he talks, and his father talks in patois, and can't get a handle on him, does not sort of understand who his son is. I mean, that's a sort of narrative through the entire collection. And so it really speaks to stories about sort of immigration and sort of how it affects generations. So if you're the parent and you're first generation, what that experience is like, as opposed to the kids, if you become fully Americanized. And also, what does it mean when people hear your parents talk with accents? And they, you know, that question, where are you from? Well, from here. No, where are you really from? Which is something we've heard lots of people talk about, right? When they say, no, I was actually born here. So it is really sort of, to me, feels in a surprising way, sort of timely, although that wasn't the author's intention to sort of, you know, be sort of newsworthy in that way. That is just his real experience.
I would follow on with that by saying, much like Renee and Anna said, authenticity always attracts me, and maybe less popular in the literary marketplace sometimes these days. I want to turn the page. I want to know what's going to happen next. If all I am is inside someone's head and nothing is happening and they are not interacting with their world in any sort of way, it is less appealing. Next question. In the middle.
Either you mentioned your pet peeve was requesting a full manuscript and then halfway through them telling you they've signed with someone else. The question is, as a writer, if somebody asks for a full manuscript and you send that to them, and then somebody else asks for it as well, what's the etiquette there?
Oh, the answer, well, I guess we could talk about exclusivity. We haven't even touched on that, which I'm so not a fan of, or are you a fan of that?
No.
Okay, so we're going to talk about that. So there are certain agents, and I know a few of those, who shall remain nameless, who for some reason think that they, I guess one way for them to level the playing field is to request exclusivity, meaning you're not supposed to send it to anyone else. But I think that's bad ultimately for both the writer and the agent. So this is probably going to sound a little hokey, but it's true. When I make an offer of representation and I find out that the writer has talked to maybe 3 or 4 or 5 agents and finally, you know, decides, like, I'm going to go with Renee and says, you know, I love what you had to say about my novel and ideas you had for revising it, right? And then how you see my book in the marketplace, how you would pitch it, the comp titles you came up with. I think your agency is great, all that stuff. I think, okay, so this person has made a decision, you know, comparing what I said to what other agents said and all kinds of things. If you send, it's kind of like dating. If you've only dated one person in your entire life and you agree to get married at 17, you have no idea what else is out there. It's possible that marriage may last forever because that does happen. But it's also possible when you get to 25 and may think like, wow, I wish I had dated a little more. So same thing with an agent. If you've only sent, if you've sent your work to only one agent, you've talked to only one person about your work, you don't have any other perspectives. So I think the best case scenario is to get a situation where a couple of people make an offer of representation and you get to talk to a range of agents. Here's the only time I think when it's okay to grant an exclusive. So let's say you send your manuscript out and you get 40 rejections. I mean, it's just a large number. But, you know, and one agent said, I have this idea for revising it, and gave you time either on the page or on the phone, and you decide to revise it. You might want to give that one agent of all the 40, which is a very large number, that one agent who actually took time out of her busy day to give you constructive, thoughtful feedback. You might want to say, you know what, your feedback was so helpful, and I realized that was time-consuming, so before I send it out on another round, I'd like to give it to you on exclusive since you were so helpful. I think that's the only time I think an exclusive kind of makes sense.
I agree. Nobody should be asking you for an exclusive. You should have the freedom to talk to as many people as you want to. And also, what's the rush? I mean, usually, what's the rush? If you so, I'm often on the receiving end of those notes saying, "I've had three offers of representation. Where are you?" Because I'm always the slowest. And my response to that is, you know, if the author is genuinely unsure and genuinely wants to hear from me because I'm a real contender, if I'm on the top of the wish list, then I'll put everything aside and read as quickly as possible. But if the author is pretty sure that they want to go with agent A and B and they're just looking for a little affirmation, which is human. I mean, it's not. I ask the author to really like let me know. You know, are you pretty far along already? I can usually tell in the correspondent that they're saying you're really at the top of my list. Please, I want to hear from you. So I think if you're in that lucky position of having more than one offer of representation and you're chasing the slower agent, try to be clear in your own mind about how you're if you're already ranking them. We've got five minutes.
I would agree with Anna on that and with Renee in that nobody should necessarily ask for an exclusive. That said, my boilerplate does, but I don't expect it. It is courteous to let people know that you have it out with others. But yes, if I've spent an hour, 2 hours with you on the phone, which is unusual, I'm new, I have more time, I'd like to see the benefit of that perhaps first as opposed to, just you've sent it out to five of us all at once and we've all had the same time to look at it. We have 5 minutes. We can take one more question. I'm like looking. This fella here in the very center has been asking.
Hi. I'm wondering if there's an agent that you really want to work with, maybe based on other authors that they've worked with. Would it ever make sense in a query letter to suggest that you could be flexible with the percentage, like that you might be okay? No.
We work for companies, so it's not like I can say sure or Anna can say sure and then goes up to like the head of ICM and says, by the way.
Yeah, but also don't sell yourself short. Yeah. I mean, the standard is 15%.
Yeah.
And you should not be making don't undersell yourself.
Okay.
Oh, you meant for less. Okay.
I meant for more, like offering, if it was someone you really wanted to work with, say, I could give you 20% or something because I'm really interested in working with you.
No, don't do that.
Okay, and then
if anybody takes that, run. Gotcha. Run. That is not a reputable agent.
And would it, I don't know too much about deals, but would it ever make sense to take a lower advance and potentially get like a higher percentage on like money from books sold after you hit whatever the mark was to like make back the money they spent on publishing it?
I would say no, because the royalty book royalties are fairly low.
And standard.
Gotcha.
Well, so there are some small publishers that might have some wiggle room and suggest a deal along those lines, but those are the really the especially small independent publishers, and you might not even need an agent to negotiate that for you.
With that, I think we're going to wrap it up. I'd like to thank both Renee and Anna for being here today.